We're going to start with the informational meeting. We should be done by 11, if not before. As you all know, I'd like to actually open the informational hearing on foster care children using psychotropic medications. And this has been an issue that has been brought to light, I think, through a series of articles. And it certainly was of a concern with President Courtney, and he did mandate that we would be looking at this. And so now we're starting with the informational hearing. And I would like to call up Brian Johnson, the Interim Assistant Director of Children, Adults, and Families, the Department, DHS, the Department of Human Services, and then Mickey Cerise, and do you want Walter Schaefer also?
Yes, please.
All right, all three of you, please come forward. Yes, and before you start, Senator Gordley has an introduction to
make. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's a delight to introduce again Jayla Harper, who is 12 years old and in the seventh grade. She is a straight-A student, and we had the pleasure of hearing her remarks about Martin Luther King Jr. on the Senate floor today. So I'd like to say welcome to Jayla and her grandmother, Leslie Williams, who will be joining us shortly.
Welcome. I'm so excited to have you here, and you actually brought tears to my eyes on the floor. I was very impressed with your presence and what you said. Welcome. With that, let's proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services. One of my responsibilities is the administration of children, adults, and families. And while I am intimidated speaking to this august panel of senators, Jayla, I'd say I'm more intimidated speaking to you. I don't know many straight-A students. Today, Madam Chair, we're going to talk about psychotropic medications. As you alluded in your opening, there were some news stories in November. You're later going to hear from a group of people, I hope, who were active on that subject up in the Portland area in our District 2, who were working and meeting on that very subject prior to the stories. And our DHS response was to organize a department-wide response group to study it, because what the psychotropic medications, prescriptions, those touch more than just the foster children. I know you're interested today in the foster children, but we had a department-wide response, and that was chaired by Walter Schaefer, who's with us today. So I'm going to ask Mickey Cerise to speak a little bit, and then he'll introduce Dr. Schaefer, and we'll move forward.
Thanks, Brian. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise, and I'm Deputy Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families with the Department of Human Services. And because I'm from the South, let me say to this panel of ladies, Happy Valentine's Day. My mother taught me well.
That'll get you everywhere.
What I'd like to do, and what we're hoping to do today, is a brief presentation that will talk a little bit about where we've come from with this particular issue, where we are, and where we plan to move. What are the next steps that we see, at least in the near future, for the department? And I'm going to take us back to January of 96, when a policy was put into place that talked about psychotropic medications and how we would monitor that for children who were in foster care. And that policy is the policy that came under question about not being adequate to meet the needs of children in foster care today. In 1997, the Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed. That's a federal law. We've called it ASPA. I think most of you may know about that federal law. It was the single largest change in child welfare practice that we've had in decades. And Oregon implemented the ASPA, or the Adoption and Safe Families Act, in 1999. And from that, what we have seen is a complexity in the cases that child welfare workers are handling. We've also seen some complexities in the cases that are actually coming in, just the problems that the families do have as they come into our system. Most of you are keenly aware that Oregon was one of the first states experiencing the methamphetamine problems, and or at least we were the ones that I think noticed it first at a national level, and we certainly felt that effect in our child welfare system. Now, I'll fast forward to May of 2004 when a work group was formed in Multnomah County, and that work group included judges, community partners, and the Department of Human Services. And that work group worked for, I believe, about 18 months and came up with some recommendations. And their recommendations were based on the policy that was put into effect in 1996 and the current practice that was happening in the field. And as you know, from other reports that have come out recently, that even though we have something in policy, it may not be happening in practice, and so we're keenly aware of that as well. So the recommendations came forth to DHS, and DHS accepted those recommendations and did two things. We put into place some things that we could do immediately that were within current resources, and that did not require rule or policy changes. We also began drafting new policy to address as many of those needs as we could. So what we ended up with at the end of in May of 07 is a current policy that was distributed. I believe you have that, and that's the policy that we're operating within now. And we are keenly aware that that policy does not meet all of the recommendations nor the needs that we see for children who are receiving psychotropic medications or in foster care. But we do think that's a step in the right direction. The policy in May of 07 did a couple of things primarily. It increased the clarity in the policy before it and the rules before it, and defined certain aspects such as the roles of caseworkers, the roles of supervisors, the roles of foster parents, and how those entities would interact with other groups in the community, such as the medical provider who is prescribing the medication or the nurse that we have in central office for consultation. One of the things that we have noticed since we've incorporated this policy is we have had an increase in training. One of the things we've developed at the end of the work group and and receiving the recommendations is we developed a curriculum specifically around the use of psychotropic medications for foster children. And we also increased the training available to child welfare staff and to foster parents. So, and that was something we could do in practice. We didn't need rule or policy change for that. But in June of 06, we began drafting policy, and again in May of 07, those policies and rules were adopted, and some other enhancements in that 07 policy include guidelines on how to keep records and how to monitor the medication once a child is receiving psychotropic medications. We identify what's been called red flags. If, for instance, a child is a certain age or is receiving three or more medications, there are some steps that need to be taken. We have guidelines for consultation with the nurse or with a licensed healthcare provider that's prescribing the medication. We also clarified the guidelines for storage of medication when the child is in the foster home, and this would be a requirement for our foster parents. We also included how to handle general emergency situations, and I know we're talking about psychotropic medications, but one of the things that we are keenly aware is that as an agency, we need to look at the child's medical needs in total, and the use of psychotropic medications is one piece of that fits under that criteria.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I think in 03 I had a bill that said that teachers will not diagnose kids for psychotropic medication. There was a rush to by in some schools to say, okay, either you get your kid on medication or he's not going to be here or she's not going to be here. But it's kind of fuzzy about who actually does the diagnosis. Now, you know, which health are you talking? A pediatrician who really understands the behavior of the child, whether or not the child is very bright and very bored, and he doesn't need or she doesn't need psychotropic. I'm still a little bit concerned about what steps are being taken, and particularly in foster care, where the parents may want to be more interested in control than what is best for the child. So could you address that?
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, that's an excellent question. And I think your question actually points to one of the conflicts that we've had within our current, even in our current policy, and that is the role of a social worker versus the role of a medical professional. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, the licensed healthcare provider that we refer to in the policy would be the primary physician or the prescribing physician. So that could be a psychiatrist in some cases, could be a pediatrician, could be a family practitioner, but it would be a doctor who would be prescribing those medications.
And just a follow-up on that point, I had gotten testimony from I cannot remember the source, I apologize, where they are saying that the majority of children in foster care are receiving their medication from one particular physician. Do you have any, are you aware of that piece of information?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. Are you saying that
most kids who come into foster care really don't have a primary care physician, and so most of these medications are being written by one physician?
Well, the way we would envision this policy playing out would be that if the child has a primary physician and can handle the medical needs of the child, we would hope that child will stay with that primary physician that they have. Unfortunately, in our foster care system, we may find a situation where we're having to relocate that child to a foster home that might move them from one provider to another provider, and then we would seek medical assistance from that second provider. However, the medical records of the child should follow the child to that second provider if that becomes a need.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're not aware of that statistic that would suggest, a single licensed physician is issuing. But we can check that out. We have two problems I'd mention. One is our data has not been sufficiently accurate to make some informed decisions along those lines. But we can find out the answer to your question. The second question that Senator Morissette raised a moment ago, I'd like to address, if I may, and that is that we don't make the prescribing decisions. Those are made by a licensed person entitled to make them. However, we have a big problem, and one of the suggestions you'll hear in our next steps is we don't get enough of our foster kids in for a mental health assessment. We're down at like 31%. We should be at 100%. And because of that, foster families do like to take their children to their family physicians, and their relationship with their family physicians could result, Senator Morissette, in exactly what you're afraid of.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Okay, I just want to make clear, because what you said is in the rule, those who are prescribing are physicians. I mean, we have a much broader universe of folks with prescribing authority, but you're saying in rule it is physicians, or does it include PAs and
practitioners? I think the exact language in rule, I believe, is licensed health provider.
Which could be a PA or an NP or...
Okay. That's... Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
Senator Carter and then Senator Morissette.
I want the record to be clear in terms of the question that the chair just asked, because I'm very familiar with the foster care system, and I have friends who have foster kids, and they all have different doctors. But her question is a yes or no. Does the department, as a policy, send children to one prescribing physician for a psychotropic medication to be administered?
I can come back to the committee and give you an answer to that. If I'm understanding your question, you're asking if we have a single physician, for instance, in Multnomah County that we send the children to?
Right.
And I am not aware that that would surprise me if we do, but I would let me check into that and get back with the committee.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm a little bit concerned about any willing provider. Any willing provider includes dentists, chiropractors, osteopaths, you know, just all kinds of people could write a prescription. And I'm concerned because the pressure to control behavior could be the top priority, whether or not it's the proper means of doing it. And again, there are so many examples of children who do not need this kind of medication, who are acting out for different reasons and being bored and so on, or you know. So I would like to try to refine that definition of provider.
Okay. All right, let's move on.
And just briefly, a couple of other areas that we sought clarification in the new policy. I think I mentioned this earlier, but the roles of the foster parent, the caseworker, and the supervisor be a little bit clearer in how we see those roles and boundaries in working with these children. And then finally, how do those entities then close a loop with the parties in a case, because we have a legal arena around that child, and what is expected of the guardians and the people providing the care and supervision of that child? What is their responsibility in getting notices to the parents and the child's attorney and the CASA, et cetera? And as Brian mentioned, in November of 2007, Dr. Goldberg saw this as an issue, and actually saw this as a global issue with the entire department, because we serve a number of populations that receive medications and other medical services. And he requested that a work group be formed, and Dr. Schaefer was the chair of that, or is the chair of that work group. And they began looking at this issue from the department perspective. However, Dr. Goldberg did ask him to prioritize children in foster care, and so the work group began by looking at those kids that are receiving psychotropic medications and are in foster care. And at this point, the second hand that you have is a draft report from the medication management work group that Dr. Schaefer chairs, and with your permission, I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Schaefer to give you an overview of that document.
Thank you. And can you do it in 10 minutes?
Yes.
All right.
Chair Monis Anderson.
Because if our questions aren't answered, we're going to bring you back. But because we have a full schedule with a lot of people coming from far away, I want to make sure that they get to testify. But I know that we'll be calling you back.
All right. Sounds good. Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Walter Schaefer, and I'm the Medical Director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. And as Mickey Series just said, I did have the pleasure of leading this DHS team looking at the issues of psychotropic medications in foster children. It rapidly became apparent to the team that although there's a lot of medication prescribing, and we do need to, as a department, attain better monitoring and oversight of that, the real issue is how to develop a system of care that meets the emotional and mental health needs of these vulnerable kids. So our mutual goals are to assure the safety of foster children who are on medication, but really to improve the overall quality of the mental health care that they receive, so that we can decrease the need for so many medications. So I want to tell you briefly what our team found and what we are recommending to the department to develop. Although the draft report is fairly lengthy, there is an executive summary at the beginning, and you can follow along as far as an outline of our recommendations. And this was an internal DHS team that was made up of representatives from child welfare, addictions and mental health division, the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, all of the parts of DHS. So what did we find? First of all, the prevalence of emotional and behavioral disorders in the foster children is very high. Looking at the Oregon statistics, just from diagnoses that are on the administrative claims, 11% rate of depression in foster children, 12% rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, attention deficit disorder, 21%. And when you think of it, trauma, emotional trauma is pretty much universal in these kids. But when you add physical abuse, sexual abuse, methamphetamine use, other drug use in the parents that resulted in the kids being placed in foster care, in recent years the number of foster children has increased, but the complexity of their mental health needs has also increased. Medications to deal with these diagnoses are plentiful, and so 27% of foster children are on some sort of psychotropic medication.
How many?
27%. And that's any medication that's intended to alter or affect the thought processes, moods, or behavior. So that's the stimulant medications for attention deficit disorder, antidepressants, antipsychotic medications, mood stabilizers. When you add it all up together, 27% of the kids are on some sort of medication. 16% of them are on stimulants. 9% are on the atypical antipsychotic medications. And those are rates that are, for those specific medications, are 5 to 6 times what the non-foster children on the Oregon Health Plan received. So,
yes, Senator Gourley.
Thank you, and I apologize for interrupting. But are you able to disaggregate that information, the 27%, by gender, by race, ethnicity, by age? I'm looking at the OARs that you have shared with us, and I'm noting that there's a new language that says that caseworkers are to notify supervisor, et cetera, when a child under 6 years of age has been prescribed a psychotropic medication. So that leads me to ask, or makes me wonder, how many children under age of 6 are getting these medications. I'm asking you a number of questions now, but also, why 6? Why not 7 or 8 or under? You follow what I'm asking.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, the answer is yes. We are able to disaggregate the prescribing information, and the work group actually has looked at that. It's a yes but answer because our data systems have some problems with complete accuracy in identifying the specific prescriber, for example. But that's one of our recommendations, is that our data systems need to be improved and can be improved. But yes, we can break down the information by age, by sex, by ethnicity, by the number of medications, it does give some important information. There are a number of children under 6 who are prescribed these medications, and a number of children under 6 that are on multiple medications. It's not a high number, but it's the type of prescribing that is of concern, and the exact age and number of medications that cause concern is something that, it's a matter of debate. But the way we sometimes phrase the concern is prescribing that's too young, too many, too much. For kids that are, too young, that are on too many medications and on too high doses of these medicines, it's something that we need to get a better handle on. And as a as an agency that's responsible for these kids that are in the care and custody of the state, we have a responsibility to do that. So
thank you.
So the summary point is that these medications are plentiful and they are felt to be effective by the prescribers, but the main concern is safety, that there are not a lot of long-term studies with these medications and their use in kids, particularly the antipsychotic medications are not approved by and large, not approved by the Food and Drug Administration for use in children, and so much of the use is what we'd call off-label, and there are safety concerns. Looking at who is actually doing the prescribing, just to address the point that was raised earlier, the majority of the prescribing actually is by psychiatrists, and it's not just one, there's no one prescriber, but much of the prescribing for, and especially when you get into the stimulant medications and even the antidepressants, much of it is by primary care physicians, who are the ones that the foster parents can access most easily. The main problem is, although medications are plentiful, other services that these kids need are not plentiful. The caseworkers, I would say, are overloaded with the caseload. Mental health services in general are overloaded with their caseloads, and there's a real lack of ability to access mental health services, and we don't have a system that links the foster kids with mental health services very well. And as Mickey Cerise pointed, or I think it was Brian Johnston pointed out, the rate of mental health assessments for these kids is supposed to be 100%, and within 60 days, and we're currently in the 30 to 35% range for even getting the mental health assessments for these kids. So the basic problem is that medications are being prescribed when because other psychosocial supports are not as available as they should be, and we heard that from everyone, basically from foster parents, but also from the prescribers, from the pediatricians, that they're prescribing higher doses and more medications because other mental health services are not available. We just don't have a child welfare system that's staffed or oriented towards these mental health and medication needs. We have basically in child welfare one nurse who is responsible for the oversight of almost 2,000 foster children on medications.
That's unacceptable. I don't see how we can do justice to our children when there's so little oversight. But that we will deal with
Madam
down
Chair,
the road.
That was the conclusion of our work group, that this is not acceptable. So what we need is actually a wraparound planning process for especially the kids with the most complex needs, a process that's that meets the mental health needs in a holistic fashion, that's culturally sensitive and competent, that really promotes appropriate emotional and behavioral development in these kids rather than promoting medication use. So basically our recommendations have to do with building capacity to do that, and it is going to take some resources. Just following along in the outline of our recommendations, we're going to need some regional staffing by nurses or other personnel and hopefully with mental health background to review the medications with the foster parents and the caseworkers to make sure that true informed consent is given for the use of these medications in kids, to make sure that the mental health assessments are being done and mental health services provided. And staff to provide education to the foster parents and the caseworkers on these issues. We're recommending smaller caseloads for the complex kids, kind of a specialty caseload level. We're recommending a medical director, at least part-time, for child welfare, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is to person at that level to have the credibility to review the prescribing, to review the cases with the prescribers. And the other reason is to develop the prescribing guidelines and policies and develop the integration of the system of care between the prescribers on the one hand and the rest of the mental health system on the other, because that system needs to be developed.
Mr. Schaefer, we're going to need to have testimony. We'll be bringing you back to give us more information probably next week, but we have some parents and case stories that need to be told, and I would love for you to stay in the room so you can actually hear him too, if that would be all right.
Madam Chair, may I put two things on the record before you dismiss us? One, I want to underscore the testimony that there is no single provider who is writing the prescriptions. And two, in answer to Senator Wardley's question, there is no distinction between sex and or age. Boys and girls both were medicated at roughly the same rate as were across the ages. We do not in this report have a racial or ethnicity, but I can get you that information.
Will you be able to bring that back to our next meeting? The disaggregated data?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes.
Thank you. And under age six as well.
Yes. I actually have a lot of that information today, but I'll make
Do you have it in the form of a handout that you can leave, that we can study in the...
I just have one copy, but
if you can make that available.
Yes,
okay, we can make copies.
We can make copies.
Yes, okay. We'll do. We'll do it today.
All right. Thank you so much, and we really appreciate the response that you have made, and it's good at the policy level, but let's make sure we get it down to the grassroots level, and I think you've already indicated that you need to work on that. With that, I would like to thank you, panel. I would like to call forward Angela Sherbo from the Juvenile Rights Department, and then go ahead with these three. Jen Nunn and Tammy Mowdy.
Tammy
Mowdy. If you could come forward to sit on either side so we can... So we only have about 25 minutes left, and I certainly want your stories heard.
Did you want me to begin?
Yes.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Angela Sherbo. I'm a senior supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I've represented children, foster parents, and parents for 30 years in three states. I've testified in front of several of you before in the past, so you know that I've also been a foster parent, that I have three sons who made it through the public school system, some with special ed needs as well. So I have some personal as well as a great deal of professional familiarity with these issues. I wanted to, I didn't have a huge amount of notice about this, or I would have provided you with more specific written testimony. What I have provided you with is a document the Juvenile Rights Project produced that is a six-point improvement to the foster care system, and I want to talk about that as the context for this specific discussion, because I think what you're seeing here is one tip of a mini-tipped iceberg. And I find it somewhat unfortunate, and as I'm sure you do too, that we address these tips, unfortunately, when they become so critical, and frankly, when they come into the public domain through the press.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an issue that was a secret to any of those of us who are in the field or to the department. So with that said, the context for this discussion is that the children in foster care in this state come to the system before they ever touch the foster care system with a number of strikes against them, as you know. They are predominantly poor. They're disproportionately members of racial minorities. They have a disproportionately high rate of disabilities. They are in the system for one of two reasons, either as a voluntary placement for placement in a psychiatric or a residential facility, because that's the way our insurance works in this country, or because a court has determined that they have been maltreated at the hands of those people they should most trust not to suffer that kind of maltreatment. So they come to you, they come to us, having been harmed at home, having psychiatric diagnoses, oftentimes cognitively impaired, many times having other disabilities as a result of prenatal exposure to drugs and alcohol. So we have a group of children who could not be more vulnerable than they hit the child welfare system. Let me say that I have enormous respect for the people who staff at the central office level and at the field level the child welfare system in this state. That having been said, and there's not a person among them who holds an ounce of ill will toward any child. Again, that having been said, a publicly funded bureaucracy and individual children with individual needs that are different, every single one of them has different and complex needs, is not a great fit. And those of you who are parents and grandparents know every one of your kids is different, and you have to do different things for each one to get a result, and that's not necessarily the way the system works. I want to read to you a quote that has been hanging on my wall. It's somewhat yellowed, as you can see. It's probably over 25 years ago. It's from the final report of the National Commission on Children. Again, I say this with the greatest respect for people on the front lines who do this work. However, this is a quote, and it really resonates with me and has throughout the 30 years I've done this work. If the nation had deliberately designed a system that would frustrate the professionals who staff it, anger the public who finance it, and abandon the children who depend on it, it could not have done a better job than the present child welfare system. We have such a long way to go. I have a lot of optimism that we can get there. We don't have that many children in foster care in Oregon. We have an average daily population of 7,000. That's enough. I mean, that's a small enough number that if we committed ourselves as the adults of this state, we could make a substantial difference. L.A. County has four, five, six times that number in one county. So that's the context. We have children with intense needs, an underfunded, overworked, and particularly, I would say, under-supervised system. So we hear a lot about the caseloads, but I want to bring to your attention the issue of quality supervision of those caseworkers and making sure there are people available who can address the nuances of every single child's needs. So that's the context I wanted to bring to your attention. I want to talk very briefly about one of the recommendations in the report, and I can also answer a couple of the questions that were previously raised. I think the issue of the one prescriber in Multnomah County, there is no one prescriber. Kids go to their primary care physician. There are several physicians who are notorious around the state and in Multnomah County for prescribing lots of meds to young children, and that may be what you're hearing. With respect to the age of children, I'm sure Dr. Schaefer has more current information for you, but in in 2004, this issue was very important to the court community in Multnomah County. We did a lot of work as a court community on the issue, and we got a lot of data. And what I can tell you, and it's somewhat different from what Mr. Johnston just said, in Multnomah County, the percentage of kids prescribed psychotropics varied considerably by age. And so that 27% you got as a total, the numbers that I have, again, from 2004 and only in Multnomah County, but for kids 14 to 15 years, 46.2% on psychotropic drugs. 16 and older, 45.9%. And then the 7 to 10 was 23%, and the small children under 6, 2.9%. There are, and we have seen them on our caseloads, children as young as 2 prescribed more than one psychotropic medication. One of the things that happens to kids who enter foster care, I described how they enter. One of the primary, in my view, in my experience, primary things that increases their level of behavioral disorder and emotional distress is moves in care. We've cited an article in Pediatrics in the material I provided you that actually looked at kids who entered foster care with low risk for behavioral disorders and compared them based on their experience, and they just did so much better when they were in one placement. We have kids in this state. On March 31, 2007, the DHS data showed that on that date, 85 children had been in 20 or more substitute care placements in that episode, so since they had entered care, and 474 had been in between 10 and 19. So I guess my message to you is, it is the tip of an iceberg. It needs to be dealt with, but as the previous panel was saying, there is so much to do on behalf of these children. So I think I've answered the prescriber in Multnomah County question, the age question. Let me just turn very briefly to the one issue I have with the recommendations and then turn it over. One of the recommendations, and it's the one I have some concern about, sort of postpones or puts off until later a decision that I think is the critical decision for the department to make and for you all to oversee, and that's who gives informed consent. There's a lot of material here. There has been consistent advice to the department, at least from the Multnomah County Court Group and from my office, that the state of Oregon, who's the guardian, who is accountable to the child, the parent, the court, the attorneys, ought to be making that decision. That it is an enormous decision to make, and the child's guardian, it doesn't have to be in the form of the inexperienced caseworker. It's the state of Oregon's obligation to do that. We have too many children. Sometimes children are in foster care for their whole lives with a grandma. Well, obviously, she ought to have a ton of input into what happens to that child. But also, as I've just told you, sometimes children are in foster care going place to place to place. No one knows them. And to have that person making the decision is, in our view, the wrong way to go. And so the only piece of this document that I've seen that concerns me is the postponement until later, when there isn't this kind of attention for that decision. And so I would urge you to keep that in mind.
Thank you so much. And if we need some clarification or more testimony, would you be available to come back next week?
Yes, with a tiny bit more notice than I had this time.
Well, we're, you know, and I've said it before, I do not like this short supplemental session.
It's very important to me. I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. Question. Yes, Senator Carter.
Ms. Chervo, thank you. I've always enjoyed your testimony and your commitment to our kids in the state, so thank you.
Thank you
for your work. My question is, as it relates to your suggestion that the department, that consent issue, and as a society, we're all trying to deal with these issues. When we have a kid who cannot be behaviorally responsible in the classroom, and the schools say, we can't take this kid anymore, because we can't afford one-on-one teaching for this kid. So you need to medicate them so they can calm down and settle down a little bit. And in our effort to try to make sure the kids are exposed and can access the best quality of education that we have in this state, we try to conform to the request of what it takes to keep this kid behaviorally responsible and accountable in the classroom. What would be your suggestion in terms of how we try to satisfy that need between the home, the school, and the child? And I know that's a big question.
It is. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Carter. I take your question to be, are there less restrictive, less intrusive means to achieve the result that we all want, which is a child who's ready to learn, able to learn, and is learning. And all I can say to you is medications are one part of a very complex puzzle. I'm not suggesting that that we not approve medication for children that's prescribed by a psychiatrist, prescribed by their primary care physician. But what's lacking, that's a piece of an overall treatment plan, and in many cases that's lacking. We have had enormous success, frankly, with many of our clients in doing far less restrictive things in the school. So for an example is a school that wanted permission to restrain a special ed student. And instead, the wraparound team came up with the use of scented towels, and it worked. You know, I mean, there's just an enormous, and that may be like a very happy story, but there are enormous range of interventions that we need to try. With respect to having the department, the decision maker, I think that's the only way we can assure accountability. Again, I'm not suggesting that they wouldn't approve it, just as they would approve an appendectomy or, you know, oral surgery for a child in their care, but that it needs to be the decision of the guardian of the child, just as it's my decision about my children and yours about yours, and not the person with whom they are temporarily placed. And there's a great deal of debate about this. I know the foster parents feel strongly.
Thank you, thank you. We need to move on, and thank you so much. And I know this is an issue that we're going to be addressing further in the interim if it isn't next week, but we'll do that. Yeah. All right. With that, Jan Nunn, please introduce yourself.
My name is Jan Nunn, and I am here today, and I have my statement prepared, but being an advocate of mental health and preaching education, 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 I was thrilled to get the education from Dr. Schaefer's testimony of the realization that over the course of the last 8 years, 13 of the medications that I counted on this tiny little sheet have been prescribed to my child that were psychotropic medications by his definition.
Mm-hmm. Now, explain to us, do you have a foster child? Or
my son is currently in a foster care placement.
Okay.
Yes. When he entered the system, he was not in foster care. Foster care was a result of the breakdown. And that's why I come before you today, to give voice to my children. And today I share only but a few of our trials and tribulations with you in hopes that those who will inevitably follow along the same path will be met with more timely, better equipped, knowledgeable recognition and understanding, rejuvenated and educated resources. When our family originally became involved with CSD, way back then, 8 years ago, they were called CSD. It is out of the deepest thanks, respect, and revered memory of so many who have came and left before us that I still refer to the department today is CSD. When my son was first placed in CSD care, he took one medication. Over the course of the last 8 years, he has been on as many as 14 prescribed medications a day. Off the top of my head, I can say that four of those medications were the psychotropic medications that are being addressed here today. Some of which were two doses a day, a couple of which were three doses a day, three of which were Class C drugs, that is, controlled narcotics, four of which were to help counteract the dangerous side effects to my son, which, by the way, posed a greater threat to my son because of a well-documented medical condition he has suffered from since the age of three. It was during this time of 14 medications a day that CSD dumped him with the best foster family in the world. Okay, I may be slightly biased on that one fact, but they've proved it true. I say dumped because they allowed none of his belongings forwarded to him. They provided only a child 14 medications with not even any information or instruction regarding those medications for the foster family. Well-documented medical condition, that is, except by CSD. It took 2.5 years of constant bickering with the department and ultimately a court order to get that information into his medical records. It also finally took a court order to get his well-documented allergy to lithium into his medical records. Two of these, along with two well-documented medical issues into his records with the department, two of the medications will now be a daily lifelong routine for my son, irreparable damage to his body done, a direct result of being silenced too long. For many months, my son was overdosed on a daily basis with Benadryl. This was also in conjunction with several psychotropic, in addition to several psychotropic medications a day. The word overdose I use here is an accurate quote of the diligent and qualified employee at Pfizer Pharmaceutical, the manufacturer of the allergy drug Benadryl. Its widespread misuse has often been a well-intended, though still unknown, long-term dangers or side effects posed. The practice of sedation in many medical areas continues today. It is of interesting note that not even the manufacturer of this drug recommends this usage of their product or is aware of any information or study regarding long-term effects of the administration of this medication for other than which it was manufactured. It is also noteworthy that the only party which of whom this was brought to their attention, agencies that included his treatment providers, DHS, CASA, and mental health, the only one who understood the dangers of this practice and intervened for this child was the drug manufacturer. All the while, there was a natural, safer alternative available at almost every pharmacy and local supermarket. These are but a few realities for my son's childhood since his involvement with CSD. Over the course of the years as well, my son has been given at minimum 14 major and different diagnoses. He has been given at least twice as many medications ranging from amphetamines to vitamins, psychotropics to antipsychotics, and antidepressants to natural alternatives. He has required 3 psychiatric hospitalizations. He has been placed in 4 foster homes. He has been placed in 4 different residential treatment care facilities for a combined duration of 5 of the 8 years we have been involved. And he has been in 2 other placements as well. He is currently residing successfully in his 4th foster home placement. After a 490-day inflicted separation, we were finally reunited only this month by the exemplary professional efforts of his new therapist. I am happy to report that today, 13 years after our journey began, because of my son's immeasurable endurance, his brother's and his dad's numerous sacrifices, the commitment and integrity of a few truly professionals, and our family's determination and perseverance, he has only one additional medication to the 2 lifelong meds. And yes, it is an antipsychotic medication. And today, he finally and deservedly has almost 1 year of success. For almost 8 years now, I have posed the question to just about everyone who has ears. Who protects the children from those who are supposed to be protecting them? It is only recently I discovered the answer to this question. It is those few who notice, hear, and listen to the silent statistics, endure to forge a new path, a right path, and give voice to those who have been long silenced. Thank you for making just a few long-waiting silences audible.
Thank you, Jan, so much for coming. It takes a lot of courage for you to come up before us and share your story, and it is going to make a difference. It will make a difference. Thank you so much. Yes,
very briefly. It's interesting because I could not have passed my bill about psychotropic drugs without the representative from Novartis, whose company makes Ritalin. He's the one who helped me pass the bill because he saw problems with the misuse and misdiagnosis. So there are good people out there.
There are.
Represent.
There are.
Yeah.
You just have to keep sounding off till it's heard.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much, Jan. Tammy, is it Maudie?
Yes.
And introduce yourself and bring that. And then if Steve McRae could come up.
Well, I'm Tammy Mowdy. My husband and I have been foster parents for 27 years. We've had a total of almost 300 children in and out of our home, some for short periods. We have adopted 7 of our foster children and still have 5 of them at home. Also have foster children at home and a granddaughter that we're raising. And over the years, through all that number of kids, we have had some real sad stories about over-medication to safe placements. And, you know, the caseworker and the doctor were right behind it. We had a 5-year-old boy that took clonidine 3 times, excuse me, 3 times a day. He'd wake up, have breakfast, take his pill, go back to sleep, get up for lunch, take his pill after lunch, go back to sleep, and the same thing in the evening. After I had him for 2 days, I called the doctor. I said, I need an appointment now. Well, in our county, to get an appointment at mental health with a doctor is just, there's no way to do it. But they heard my frustration, and I had been around long enough that they let me get in. And with them, because of the type of medicine it was, it took us a month and a half to get him off that medicine so he could function. When I asked the doctor why he was on that kind of medication, so much of it, he said, well, we needed to save the placement. And I said, with the foster parents? He said, yeah. Well, I had had an opening, could have taken him 2 or 3 months before. But apparently the caseworker didn't have time to check who else could take him, so they drugged him up instead. And then about 4 years ago, we had a child that's a sister to one we adopted, and we got that child because the prescribing person for her medication said, you know, I want her to come to your house for an evaluation if you can handle her for a couple of months. Well, we'd never been able to handle her for too long before, but, you know, she's older. I said we would try. And she had a total of 9 medications she was on. Now, she has been stable. We adopted her 2 years ago. She's doing well in school, and she's on 1 medication. And the reason that the prescriber was wanting her out of the home is that the foster parent had come up with yet another medicine that they thought would help this child maintain. And most of it was behavior stuff that mom and her fighting and arguing. You know, I find that when schools want kids to take certain medication, one of the first things I do is take 2 or 3 hours a day and go sit with my child in school. So I can really see what his behavior is. No, he's not going to act the same when I'm there as that he would otherwise. But maybe the teacher can get some ideas of how I handle him so they could handle him better too. And I believe that's part of that education on this whole thing that is missing. When I call a caseworker and say, you know, I've had this kid for a year and a half, it's just gotten really out of hand. What do you think about getting her on meds? And the caseworker said, well, you know, that's something we've never tried. She'd been in care 2.5 years. We'll try that. And by the time we got to the doctor, we started working a different way with this child. She's went to the doctor 2 times now at mental health. She's not on medication, but her family is able to exist because we changed our parenting. We talked in depth to the therapist, and we said, hey, you know, what else can we do? What, I mean, the little girl peaches people with her nails. She's the only girl I have out of 6 that grows her nails. She pinches everybody when she doesn't like what they do and leaves marks on. She pinched 3 times in the last 3 weeks because I finally got smart enough to say, if you don't pinch today, you get your nails painted tonight. If you do pinch, your nails get cut. That was something I really should have put her, but my kids had marks all over them. She was throwing things, and she was marking my children, and we couldn't seem to stop, and I didn't know what to do but medicine. And finally, I sat down and thought, and I think there was a lot of that needs to be done. And I know when I call a caseworker and say, you know what, this kid's just really giving me a bad time. I followed your direction. We went into the doctor. Which our pediatricians in my county will not prescribe. They make you go to mental health, which there isn't enough time to get them into mental health. But yes. I'll call and say, okay, they put this child on this. And almost every time the caseworker will say, well, what is that? What does it do? We do not have educated foster parents. If I had my way, every time a child got on any kind of major drug, they would have to go to a training on that drug. I mean, I know I can get on the internet, I can talk to friends, I can talk to the doctor at depth when I get that medication. But that's all at a time when I'm maybe not processing everything that's being said. And I think it should be required that foster parents have, you know, DHS offers training, but if it's on the night of the week that your family goes to church, or if it's on the night of the week that something else is going on, but if it was required, people would go. I also believe caseworkers need to be trained in what's going on. And I think I heard of a little girl last night that's on 30 medications. I have personally tried to take one of my kids in and have him put on medications. He was 6, and the third time he tried to stab me, I said, I either can't take him anymore or he needs to be medicated, because he was going to kill somebody at 6 years old. So there are kids out there that really need it. But if the foster parent doesn't know what to recommend, and the caseworker doesn't know what they're getting, and the supervisor doesn't even know they're on meds sometimes, you know, what are we doing to them? Yeah.
Thank you so, so very much for this information. And from a department out there, there are 8 things that, and I think you're probably hearing it, but quality supervision, the number of placements and moves the average child has, who gives informed consent, how to deal with teachers and the students in the classroom, and then educating the foster care workers and the caseworkers, and appointments for medical yes. appointments. So there might be more. We have Steve McRae and then 2-3 others after this, and I am willing to go through the noon hour since I don't have a meeting at the noon hour for those that are here for 16. So please, if you can add something new. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve McRae. I am the program coordinator for CASA for Children, which is in Multnomah and Washington counties. I have a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's in education, and years of experience as a mental health counselor. I've been at CASA for 11 years and did a little thumbnail calculation that I've probably seen somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 children that have been directly under my supervision through my volunteers. I was a member of the Medication Management Committee in 2004 to 2006 that gave rise sort of to the initial impetus that has led where we are today. And I want to say I'm very happy that the committee is taking the time to hear about this, because it's an issue that I've been working on for many, many years and was feeling like the lone voice in the wilderness for a long time. It's wonderful to have everybody taking this so seriously. I feel like I'm telling the beginning of the story after the end's already been told here, but I wanted to fill you in a little bit on what brought this committee about, the concerns that were raised, so that you have more of a sense of what the problem is we're trying to address here. The committee was started by the Multnomah County judges. There were 3 or 4 judges that got together and talked to the chief judge and said, we're seeing certain things that are concerning to us. The observations they made were that were concerning to them, among others, very young children on psych meds. We've already talked about children on 4 to 8 medications or more at a time. The most I've seen was 11. I'm hearing about 30 is just frightening. Children who need medication in one setting and then move to another, which we heard a great illustration of from our foster parent here, that depending on where they're living, they seem to somehow change what they need, which didn't make sense to them. Foster parents appearing to drive the decision-making process, and not necessarily a good or a bad thing in terms of what happens to the child, but depending on who the foster parent was, the children would be getting a different kind of treatment. The caseworkers did not appear to be that interested in really covering that, sort of like the doctor said, this is what's going to happen, so this is what's going to happen. Who am I as a caseworker to question these kinds of decisions? And I'll come back to that point. So that was a concern. And also, as been mentioned, there's a few physicians around who have a very ready prescription pad, and certain people knew who they were. And you can see how that combined with the last point, if you have a foster parent who really believes medication is a good thing for everybody and has a physician who is with them on that and the caseworker's not watching, that's how we sometimes get into these really difficult situations where the kids are on that many meds. So committee findings, we talked about numbers of kids on meds. I would just add that over 70% of the kids in residential treatment are on psychiatric meds. Most of those are prescribed by psychiatrists, and those are usually the situations where we get into the kids on 4, 5, 6 medications at a time or when they're institutionalized. So it isn't that they're getting these in foster care. They're also getting them in institutional settings at a very high rate. Another thing we found was that the policy that was in place was not being followed. It primarily involved informing the foster care parent, informing the caseworker about getting a prescription, and then the caseworker having 7 days to inform the parties in writing. That basically was never happening. It is beginning to happen a little bit, but I would still say, 95% of the time, I do not get those notifications. The COSTA is a party to the case and is supposed to be receiving those. And we don't, and the attorneys that I talk to report they don't also. We explored the amount of training that was available for workers and foster parents around psychotropic medication, and the frightening answer was none. Absolutely no training was available about the policy, about the law, and about the psychotropic drugs themselves. So we have people making decisions, both foster parents and caseworkers, who had no idea what it is that they were deciding about, unless they managed to get that training on their own in some way. Medications were frequently prescribed reactively based on behavioral changes, as we again eloquently heard described, to preserve a placement rather than as part of a comprehensive plan to help the child with their behavior. We talked about that piece. Okay, and the other thing I think that was very important was that side effects are often not recognized or were ignored when they were obviously present. A short example, a child that I met in court, her hand was just vibrating constantly the whole time you talked to her. She had a whole bunch of things that she did about twisting her fingers and cracking her knuckles, sitting on her hands to stop her hand from shaking. When I asked the psychiatrist, what is it, we're concerned about the side effects, his immediate response is, we haven't noticed any side effects. And it's the most obvious thing in the world that it was a side effect. They told her it was because she was nervous. Very disturbing. There's other examples of that I could give. So recommendations that we made, actually, I am very, very happy with the recommendations that DHS has come up with, mm-hmm. because they pretty much followed the recommendations that our committee came out with. The points that I would want to emphasize specifically, Ms. Sherbo, I think, was very eloquent in stating the DHS worker or the agency needs to be the agent giving informed consent. I think I gave a little illustration earlier in our foster parent as the reason why. We can't be going by the philosophy of the provider that happens to have control of the children at this time. It needs to be part of a larger picture. And that's the second point, is that the medication needs to be part of a larger behavioral emotional health strategy that includes the kinds of planning that our foster parent, again, eloquently described. I'll give you another situation here where we had a child who was his father murdered his brother. He was removed from the home. The father disappeared from his life. He went to the funeral, I guess. He was only 4 or 5 years, 4 years old at the time. They told him his brother was in heaven. He didn't know where his father was. His mother's a year and a half later, mother's parental rights were being terminated. He blew out at his daycare setting at that time. We asked the mental health provider, what's your treatment plan? She says, oh, it's the same as it was in February, you know, several months before the termination of parental rights, before him blowing out. There was no change in the plan. They were going to take him in and put him into day treatment and to put him on risperidol. We got him to see a specialized counselor, which I tell you, took moving heaven and earth because it's not paid for by their own health plan. That person explained to him where his father was, where his brother was, why his father wasn't seeing him anymore, why he was in foster care. He's now in a regular kindergarten setting and going to an after-school daycare and a family. That's the kind of thing, change, that can happen if you stop and look at the big picture. And that's what's not happening in many, many, many of these cases. So the big concept that we wanted to get across as our committee was, we don't have to be experts in psychotropic medication in order to question some of these decisions. If we think of it as the agency and the courts and the CASAs and the attorneys as kind of the collective parent for this child, if our child was getting this kind of care, would we accept that? If the answer is no, we should not accept it for our foster children. We cannot go with the idea that just because the doctor says so, that that makes it okay. Some ongoing concerns I have here that I will share, and then I will stop. Foster parents are not being provided adequate support for children having difficulty in their care. The easy thing for them to do is to see the physician. That's quick, and it's paid for. They need to have behavioral consultants on call. I understand that in the developmental disabilities department, if they need help with the children, a child's behavior, they can get somebody to come out within a week. To get a DHS child, to get a behavioral consultant, sometimes takes weeks or months, and again, it has to be specially approved for funding. It just should be available. Mm-hmm. And there's other services such as speech and language, such as sensory integration therapy, OT kinds of things, that are available. They're out there, and they're helpful, and they're not being given to our foster kids. And again, the foster parents shouldn't be the ones who are expected to question the decisions of the doctors. They don't have the information. They don't have the authority to stand up when a physician says it's what needs to happen.
Thank you very, very much. Any other?
One other.
We need to move on.
The foster parents also need to have incentives to do a good job with their children in foster care. At this point, the foster care parent special rates are determined based on how difficult the child is perceived to be in their care. I know of one foster parent in Washington County who had three very challenging children who were, you know, like raised by wolves kind of thing. They didn't know how to use silverware. They went to the bathroom on the walls. A year and a half later, she had them sitting at the table, saying please and thank you, passing the salt. Special rates nurse came out and said, oh, well, they're not really special needs anymore, and cut her rates because they were doing well. She should have gotten an enormous bonus. So we need to look at how we pay foster parents. Yes. We need to pay them enough money to begin with that they don't have to be scrapping for special rates in order, they don't have to prove that their children are bad enough that they need to have additional funding. And we also need to reward foster parents who do a good job. And show that they have those extra levels of skills. Thank you again.
I appreciate your work and your advocacy for these children, and hopefully you'll continue to stay in the system. Thanks so much.
And if you need me to come back, please do.
All right. Thank you. With that, Sybil Hebb, Laura Eccles, and Diana Avery, they're going to present us some challenges from the domestic violence care but regarding medication.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and I want to first start off by just expressing my great thanks to the committee, to the chair and to the members for focusing their time and attention on issues of such great importance to children in our state today. We've heard a lot of interesting and really important information about a critical issue. I want to take a moment to just shift the focus to another issue of great importance in child welfare cases and to describe to you some examples of great successes that we have seen in pilot projects across the state and share that success with you. I'd like to focus on domestic violence and child welfare cases and the challenges and solutions posed by these cases. We know that domestic violence causes a great safety threat to children in many homes in Oregon across the state. In 2006 alone, there were 2,500 found cases founded 4 threats of harm based on domestic violence. And we also know that domestic violence coexists in many other cases that come into the child welfare system. The cases are very serious cases as well. We know that there's a correlation between domestic violence and child fatalities, and we also know that domestic violence can be an indicator of more serious, severe child abuse. And so for these reasons, it's important that we ensure that our state's response to these types of, to these issues with these cases is really well informed and effective. And what we have found is that when caseworkers have the support of domestic violence experts in assessing threats to victims and children and also in creating safety plans that are informed and knowledgeable about domestic violence, they can be more effective in reaching good outcomes for children. So I'm going to turn it over to the experts here, Diana Avery from Lane County and Laura Eccles from Gresham, to talk to you about their experiences with some successful models, and we really appreciate your attention today. Thanks.
Chair and committee, I want to thank you again for your time and allowing us to be here to present information on some promising models that we've tried out here in Oregon and around the nation as well. My name is Diana Avery, and I'm a program services coordinator with Lane County's Commission on Children and Families, and I was the project director for our Green Book grant that we had in Lane County for 6 years. We were one of 6 federally funded sites participating in this demonstration project, looking for effective strategies for those cases that involve the nexus of child maltreatment and domestic violence. In Lane County, we had the opportunity to provide a co-located domestic violence advocate and a batterer intervention specialist. These were contracted positions that worked side by side with caseworkers and supervisors, trying to do a better job of assessing and case planning for those cases, those incredibly chaotic and complex cases. Our model was informed by our other pilot projects throughout Oregon as well as through the national models. We think that we had some impact, not just for families, but also for caseworkers and supervisors. We were able to take a look at FACES data for families in 2004 and 2005 who had been referred and seen by a domestic violence advocate who was contracted from our local DV agency. We were able to see a little bit of an indication of some positive impacts for mom being able to connect with a supportive advocate. We saw that those cases had fewer times when the child was removed from mom, from the non-offending parent, fewer times that those families ended up in the foster care system, and for those when children did end in care, they were there for less time than the general caseload in Lane County for 04 and 05. That's not a scientific study. It's not rigorous evaluation, but it's a snapshot in time, and it shows some positive impact that I think we should explore further and continue to try and continue to evaluate the impact, particularly in light of some of the testimony you've heard earlier around the impact of multiple moves on children. If we're able to keep them with the non-offending parent, we're going to have a higher likelihood of safety and stability for that child and that family. We also found that when we were able to provide batter intervention consultation for caseworkers and supervisors, their ability and their willingness to engage with the father of the children, the perpetrator of that persistent pattern of coercive control, increased. They were more likely to interview that individual, more likely to set a case plan and hold him accountable to that case plan. That resulted in a couple of things. One, caseworkers and their supervisors were better able to assess mom's protective strategies and build on them and allow her to have some success as a healing option for her child. They were also better able to assess the threat of harm, the safety threat that that perpetrator posed to those children, and case plan and hold him accountable for his behavior and his impact on that family. They were more able to document the actual threat to that family. So we also know that caseworkers were able to receive better supervision from their supervisors, who were more able to bring to bear national and local information around the emerging field of batterer intervention. We think it's an effective model. We'd like to support you in whatever further information you'd like, either from our projects around the state or nationally, as you continue to think about these issues. Thanks.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you very much for listening to this issue today and inviting us here. My name is Laura Eccles, and I work for an agency called Listen to Kids in Portland, and I'm part of the Safe Start-funded grant project at the Gresham Child Welfare Branch. I'm part of a team of three domestic violence providers that's based at the Gresham Child Welfare Branch, and we've been there for almost 2 years now. And I just want to share with you a few examples of some of the things we're up to there, what we've been doing, and what we believe has been true accomplishments and successes since we've been there. The first thing that I think is important to share is that we've been able to provide a connection, an immediate connection to tangible resources and services to both survivors of domestic violence and their children, but also to the child welfare caseworkers, who we all know have a lot to do in their jobs. It can be extremely stressful to get a knock on your door from a child welfare representative investigating an issue of domestic violence that's happened in your very recent past, possibly the night before. Oftentimes, child welfare workers don't have very many resources at their disposal, so they may say, you need to go get a restraining order right now, else, you know, your children may be at risk of protective custody, or you need to go to a shelter. I don't know if you can think of this, but imagine what it might be like to be like, what do I have to do? Who do I have to call? What we're able to do is go there out there with the child welfare worker, meet the survivor of domestic violence and the children, and provide those services right there. We can help her find out how to get a restraining order, hold her hand, give her crisis support and counseling, and just help the process go a little bit easier. So connecting with her with safe shelter, if that's what she's interested, or restraining orders. The second thing we're able to do and are doing on a daily basis is the collaboration with us and the child welfare workers. That isn't possible when we're based at our own separate agencies. So being physically located in the space really promotes communication and continuity of service to these children and families. So whether it's caseworkers just stopping by our desk because they know us and they've built relationships with us, and consulting and asking for advice on a particular issue, to asking us for up-to-date information about restraining orders or shelter space, for us attending family decision meetings and help planning and collaborating and assessing safety risks and factors with the family and with the caseworkers together as a team to promote safety and well-being for the kids and the families.
And what is your title again?
Parent-child specialist with Listen to Kids.
Mm-hmm. Are you funded through a safety net program, money from the state?
No. This particular project is funded through the Safe Start grant, which is a national grant.
But there is money in our safety net program.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm not the best person to ask if I... go ahead.
Chair and Representative Greenlee, excuse me for the interruption, but people from the department...
Representative Greenlee is not in the room right now. Okay. That's fine. I'm very proud to be called. I even have a name tag. I'm very proud to be called Representative Green.
Your constituent is pointing out that I should be nice to your representative. I apologize. Okay. There are representatives of the department here who could better answer that funding question.
Okay.
In the past, though, there have been only federal grants that have been providing for this type of co-location and collaboration in Oregon over the past 10 years. There have been samples across the state, so we've learned from those experiences, but there is no statewide consistency of funding for this type of collaboration.
Okay.
Sorry. Is there more?
Yes. Is there time?
Just a couple more minutes, and then we're going to need to move on.
Thank you. So we've basically just been able to learn more about each other's roles and duties and collaborate together to work with the families and their children to promote, ideally in situations of domestic violence, to keep the children with their safe parent, usually the mother. And I just want to thank you all for taking this time.
Well, thank you very much. This is information that we need, and hopefully the department is listening and seeing how important parent specialists are and the model. And I don't know if that model has been shared with the department. Yes, they're aware.
They're aware of that, yes.
Okay.
One last thing. This is a cost avoidance program, like many other programs mm-hmm. that we have. If we put a little bit of money into it right now, we will save tons of money later on. So.
Great.
Thank you very much
for coming. With that, I'd like to close the informational hearing on the foster children and child welfare piece, and I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3616. And I'm going to do this a little bit differently. Usually we have the proponents come first and then the opposition. Sort of know what this bill is all about from last session. We know that there are changes. I want to have the concerns brought up first. So would Rob Lundblad and Cliff Johansson please come forward? If they're not here, then I would like to call Christina DeTullo. Oh, are they here?
Okay.
All right.
Sorry, it looked like it was going to be a while. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. The OPA has some serious concerns about certain parts of House Bill 3616, and I would like to turn it over first to Rob Lundblad to talk about those and then to Dr. Cliff Johansson.
Okay, for the record, my name is Robert Lundblad. I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Oregon. I have a private practice here in Salem, and I also work at the Oregon State Hospital as a psychologist. My comments here today are in regard to the OPA position on this matter, and I'm going to read some comments and then make myself available for questions as well. We understand that this issue has had a great deal of support in the House, and there are indeed some good aspects of the bill. Clearly, based on stories based in the Oregonian last summer, there is a need to regulate the use of the term counselor. And we support that attempt. However, instead of creating an actual solution to that problem, House Bill 3616 uses it as a means of reaching an entirely different end, that of requiring insurance companies to pay LPCs for their services. OPA's concern is directed at this issue. On the surface, the question of whether insurance payments are a clear extension of that practice is a problem. There is a problem with access to mental health services in the state, and I think we're going to go see that ongoing in the future. And it stands to reason that increasing the number of providers who can be paid for providing services will increase access. Unfortunately, though, there is more to this policy than whether insurance carriers should pay LPCs, or licensed professional counselors. This bill guarantees payment for services that an LPC may or may not be trained to perform. Some LPCs could arrive at an accurate diagnosis and deliver good treatment, and others would not. There's a troubling lack of consistency from program to program training programs in this country. There's also a lack of consistency between mental health provider program. Then there's also a lack of consistency in the rigor of requirements for licensing. Safety is an issue. This lack of consistency leads to concerns about the safety of citizens who receive services from LPCs and raises the question of how an LPC board will deal with unlicensed practitioners or even those who are licensed but not competent. Passage of this legislation will likely increase the number of LPCs in Oregon, yet House Bill 3616 does nothing to provide for the investigatory or disciplinary ability of the board, of that board. Without an increase in funding to provide for more investigators, the board will have little ability to police the community it is supposed to regulate and will be unable to ensure public safety in treatment with LPCs. The legislature is now going to mandate payment. It has a responsibility to ensure that the services provided are safe. The bill requires that LPCs are paid for performing services within their scope of practice. but the Oregon legislature has never actually defined what that scope of practice is for LPCs. Instead of having a practice act, which all other professionals listed in this bill do have, the LPC board has what is called a title act. This means that the legislature left it open to the LPC board to define what the LPC scope of practice is by rule. Mm-hmm. With this title act, it is within the LPC's board discretion to define the services their licensees may perform. Yet that same board does not and will not have the resources to adequately investigate and discipline their licensees. In leaving such matters entirely to a licensing board without providing adequate funding to investigate and regulate, the legislature does Oregon's LPCs and the Oregon's entire community of mental health practitioners a great disservice and does nothing to sustain public safety.
Thank you. Let's go on with your testimony and see if there's questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Cliff Johansson. I'm a psychologist in private practice. I have offices here in Salem and also in Lake Oswego. I'm here to support the amendment to remove mandated insurance reimbursement from this bill so that issues related to the Title and Practice Act issues, enforcement, and appropriate credentialing can be studied in the interim. In my opinion, the Oregonian was correct in news stories last summer that exposed a longstanding problem of unlicensed counselors putting Oregon citizens at risk for harm. I think that the Oregon legislature is correct to pass this bill and close that loophole. The bill, however, has been hijacked, in my opinion, for a different purpose, and that is to mandate insurance companies to pay them for the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders, which many of them are not qualified to do. And I'd like to take a moment to explain why I think that. I was first trained to be a counselor before I became a psychologist. I eventually realized that I was not adequately prepared to diagnose and treat mental disorders, and that's what I wanted to do. I know firsthand that the primary counseling approach taught is the Rogerian client-centered non-directive approach. And this school of thought is openly against the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. That seems pretty critical. In my attempt to discuss this issue with the board of directors of the Oregon Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, and I'm a member, as a marriage and family therapist, I'm a member of that organization, I've been told by the director of a counselor graduate training program that a one-hour lecture covering the diagnostic manual is more than sufficient preparation for the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. And I think that this is clearly wrong. I am not opposed to master's level prepared clinicians with adequate training to diagnose and treat mental disorders. The Oregon Psychologist Associate License that's administered by the Board of Psychologist Examiners is just such a license, and I do support that as a model for the LPCs.
State that again. The
Psychologist Associate is a master's level license that is administered by the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners. And it does require an adequate level of preparation in the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders. The LPCs appear to be more interested in taking legislative shortcuts than getting the needed preparation for this kind of work. The basis for credentialing master's level clinicians for the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders needs to focus on their education, their training, their supervised experience, and their current competence. And these are the criteria that are used by accrediting bodies, such as the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. And we're just asking that the standard of practice be consistent. The LPCs need to have a practice act and not just a title act. This bill does not accomplish that. The LPC board needs to have investigator positions in order to adequately send cease and desist letters to unlicensed counselors. And put the teeth in this bill that is needed. So I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
The questions at this point in time?
Your piece pretty well
sums up what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's very
thank
helpful.
You very much.
This won't come. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dr. Johansson, I'm one of those people who graduated with a master's degree in counseling, and mine happened to have not been Rogerian. And so I think that there are schools that don't just train but give people choices in terms of the methodology and the role models that they want to be trained after. So I think that might be a little, that one is a little tight for me.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I do acknowledge that there is a variety of different kinds of training. I think that for many, many years, the Rogerian was the dominant.
Yes.
And I hope with my comment to stimulate some discussion about just exactly.
Yeah, because I'm very Thorndickian in nature.
should I say something about generations?
You're right.
I might add to that a little bit. I, in my work at the Oregon State Hospital, I supervise terminal master's level clinicians as they go through their final 6 months internship in clinical training. And at the beginning, we do talk about the nature of training and their level of preparation to do the work that they are going to be faced with at the hospital. I think at the beginning, they feel very confident. At the end of their internships, they really do note their limitations as far as I really don't know what I'm talking about in regard to this in some cases. So it's just kind of an anecdotal aspect, I think, supportive that it's more than taking a class. It's being part of a process of the diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders.
Thank you very much. And you have submitted which amendment? Do you know what?
Madam Chair, we haven't seen what number the amendment
okay.
is, but it's the one that would remove the insurance mandate portion of the bill for now.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will be continuing this on Friday and probably next Monday, but I think we have the information, and if we need more input, we'll get a hold of Betsy. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. I had received a number of emails and phone calls regarding art therapy, and so let's start with the art therapist. Christina
DeTullo.
Jody Wynn
Walker.
Wynn Walker and Sherry Epstein.
Yes.
All right.
So, information.
And it'd be nice if you could let us know. I think you will. Your education, training, and supervised experience, also.
Yes. And we have information being passed out to you.
Okay. Perfect. And please introduce yourself.
Hello, Chair and Committee. Thank you very much for having us here today. My name is Christina DeTullo, and I'm a registered art therapist. We come before you today to speak on the behalf of the profession of art therapy. I am currently employed at both Legacy Emanuel Hospital and the Children's Hospital, working within their art therapy department, and I'm also employed at the Cartini Clinic for Disordered Eating, working with children and adolescents who have eating disorders. My education was I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and received my master's in art therapy there. That program is approved by the American Art Therapy Association. It's composed of 60 credit hours and field work. And after graduating there, graduates can sit for the Illinois counselor's exam, which many of my alumni have. The education is equivalent to, or even in some cases with some art therapy programs, even more rigorous than counseling education because of the added specialty of needing to know the techniques of using art within the therapeutic process.
And do you use that with just children, or is that used with adults also?
Art therapy is used with extreme range of people,
okay.
You know, anywhere from 5 up to 99. So.
Okay.
So would you like us each to introduce ourselves, or would you like me to speak on that?
Just speak on your behalf.
Okay. So I'm here because of our concerns of House Bill 3616, because of the language specifically where it is taking the terms counselor, counseling, therapist, and therapy, and there is no listing in the exemptions area, including art therapists or any creative art therapists. there is an exemption for the drug and alcohol counselor, and art therapists have more training than a drug and alcohol counselor.
And so you are referring to
Section 5.
Section 5.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Art therapists, there are actually over, there are 89 art therapists here in the state of Oregon who are practicing, who are registered or board certified, which means taking an exam through the Art Therapy Credentialing Board. And in some states, that is equivalent to the LPC exam. And then there are probably about 100 total art therapists, some who are working towards their registration here in Oregon. So they are working in a variety of different settings, mental health settings, rehabilitation centers, prisons, a range of settings, and working with all age groups. So by excluding the language in the bill right now, in excluding art therapists, would be affecting a huge range of your constituency by denying them services, because art therapists would be denied the use of being use the term therapy or therapist.
So if we had an amendment, which I think has been drafted, that would add you to Section 5.
Section 5.
Yes. It would not include you in Section 2, which is the reimbursement, is my understanding.
Correct. Right. An art therapist would have to go through the counseling board to become an LPC.
Yes.
For that.
Yes. Okay. All right. Any questions? All right. Next.
Yeah. Thank you for hearing us today. My name is Sherry Epstein. I'm a registered and board certified art therapist, and I also have the NCC credentials, which is National Certified Counselor. So I have two certifications, and if this was to pass, I couldn't use either of those, any of my credentials at this point. And I've been practicing for 15 years. Spent the first 8 years in community mental health and actually working with the kind of clients that you were hearing about earlier, foster children, primarily. That was at Mental Health Services West, where I began in 1993, and I was a child and family therapist there. When I began there, a full caseload was 20 clients per week, and these are children that were very damaged in all kinds of ways that you've already heard about. When I ended there in the year about 2000, a full caseload was 44 clients per week. I just heard from another therapist this morning, our therapist who's working in Lane County Mental Health, and her caseload now as a child and family therapist with art therapy background is 57 clients per week. There is no way we could serve the clients that we were responsible for helping. So hearing these stories kind of breaks my heart. It takes me back to those times when we were on the front lines. We were sort of the MASH unit trying to take care of these children, seeing awful things happening to them over time in the foster care system and medically with medications. Art therapy is extremely valuable in these settings, and we were desired in these settings, art therapist interns. Art therapy is able to get down below the verbal language of therapy, which is useful, but it also accesses the emotional states, the trauma, the memories that these kids have, and especially in the early years of their lives when we don't have language to explain what is really going on here that's disturbing people, causing emotional distress. So I got a little off track there. I feel very strongly about this. I worked for 8 years, and honestly, by the end of that, I was worn out and physically not able to do the job anymore with the amount of stress that's involved in helping this clientele. At that point, I did go into private practice without any intention of getting insurance reimbursement for what I did. That was an accepted part of what I took into consideration. My concern is that, as has been stated, if this Section 5 is passed in this language, I won't be able to use my credentials. I won't be able to continue to work at all in this field that I spent 15 years. As I mentioned earlier, I have two certifications, which I also have the ATR. That's the registration, which required supervision. And all of that's in the information I've handed out to you about art therapy and the different requirements for ATR and then for board certification. Board certification requires a test NCC requires an examination, and my understanding is that the NCC is fairly equivalent to, at least when I took it in 1995, was equivalent to the licensure exam in the state of Portland, Oregon, I'm sorry. When I did my internship at Mental Health Services West, and most, as far as I understand, the interns that are at Merrillhurst have always traditionally served in community mental health positions as internships.
And how long are the internships?
For 9 months.
9 months.
I was hired at the agency 2 months before I graduated with my master's because the work we did was so that I did that we were able to offer as art therapists was so valuable to treating these children. Over the years, I also there supervised interns, not just art therapy interns, but interns from at the PhD level and also in at least in group supervision. Individually, I had interns from PSU, Lewis and Clark, Pacific University, and Fox University. And my experience was that art therapists had very rigorous expectations from the master's degree program at Merrillhurst. We had more client contact hours required, it seemed like, and also very a lot of documentation that we had to do. So we, art therapists are highly, highly trained from Merrillhurst.
And Merrillhurst is the only
accredited
college
in, I believe,
art therapy.
In Oregon. Santiago, also in Washington. Okay.
In Washington.
Mm-hmm. So, and I believe Merrillhurst has probably graduated about 200 clients, students overall, in the years that they've had their program.
And I heard that they are now their program has changed so that you would be considered a family therapist. Is there something along those lines?
They changed their standards and their education to meet the counseling standards, and that was done probably in the early 2000s. So now current graduates can get the LPC.
Yeah. Okay.
So in what I've passed out to you, it does talk about how the populations that art therapy is effectively used for, again, all age groups, lots of different issues across the board. It's very effective in the treatment of traumatized, damaged, underserved populations who have abuse, foster kids, as I mentioned, chronically mentally ill, dual diagnosis issues. There's almost, I can't think of much of anything that art therapy can't be used to address in mental health system, either primarily or as an adjunctive therapeutic modality. Excuse me. In private practice at this time, I just wanted to bring up the concept that other mental health professionals with licensure, including psychologists and LCSWs, LPCs, respect the work that art therapists do. I'm in a psychoanalytic child study group, have been for several years, and the requirement for that is that we each take on a low-fee client who can't afford to pay more than, say, $20 or $30 an hour for treatment, and that it be long-term therapy. A year or more. I've had one client with Asperger's syndrome that I've treated that way and another with autism. So that's another service that's being provided at a very low fee. The public is already protected by the credentials of ATR or the BC and also the NCC. And I, Madam Chair, you have a full...
Mm-hmm. And my staff took it to make copies for everybody else.
Because the ADA came out to 34 pages of code of ethics that we have to follow if we have credentials through ADA, American Art Therapy Association. National Certified Counselors, that was 8 pages, so I thought I'd just give you one copy and you could pass that around. But the point is that we are already covered with codes of ethics with these certifications. And we're held to that. We can have our certifications taken away if someone complains successfully.
And who do they report to?
To the board, to the ADA, Art Therapy, American Art Therapy Association.
Well, they would be reporting to the Art Therapy Credentialing Board.
Credentialing Board.
Credentialing Board.
Which is
registration.
Where?
That is located in
Illinois.
No, it's North Carolina.
We have the information there in your pamphlet.
And that's tough for someone who wants to complain. So we may work on that later as a group with your input.
Great. And also for those credentials, I'm required to do 100 CEUs every 5 years and document that. So there is ongoing education to keep those credentials. And another piece, you know, to limit the population from access to us as art therapists or expressive art therapists is limiting. It doesn't serve the public. It doesn't do what I think this bill was trying to say it was going to do. Having therapeutic choice, I think, is important. We offer different kinds of services that are also credentialed, and we have experience and education to back it up. And also, since I always understood that I wasn't going to be able probably to get insurance coverage, I do offer sliding fee scale to clients so that they can afford to get my services. So if you were to limit that, you would have a whole population group of people who wouldn't have access at, who don't have insurance or their insurance doesn't cover the services. So I have a standard fee, but I go down so that people can afford the service as well. So I'm not here to make money. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much.
Hello, my name is Jody Winwalker. It's a delight and a pleasure to be here. I've never testified before, so this is pretty exciting for me personally. First, to thank you for your time and attention. I am the executive director of Earth Tones Music Therapy Services. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a board-certified music therapist. I was invited, actually informed about this bill from our art therapist. They emailed me, and I went, oh, my goodness, this definitely needs our attention. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this. I have 27 years of doing music therapy in the state of Oregon. I have served on our state board, Oregon Association for Music Therapy, as past president, and I'm currently the government relations representative as well as a continuing education director for our board. Let's see. I am here to represent our national association, American Association for Music Therapy. I'm here to represent our state organization, and I'm also here to represent our Oregon task force that we recently formed to address this particular issue that even came up. I'm also here to represent the consumers that have been receiving music therapy in the state of Oregon for many, many years, are currently receiving services, and hopefully here to advocate for them to be able to continue receiving services in the future. Music therapists are definitely committed to quality of life for the consumer, which means, as service providers, that we are committed to providing quality service. I'm here to make a statement of opposition to this bill, to make a recommendation for a statement of exemption, to provide the packet of information that we have given you. It gives you some basic information on music therapy, because I assume, in general, since it's only been a profession for about 57 years or so officially, there are people who it's fairly new to still. And also to give a brief definition of music therapy and the current status of music therapy in Oregon. So music therapy is really an established health care profession that uses music to address the physical, emotional, cognitive, and social needs of individuals of all ages. There's about 5,000 music therapists nationwide, and there's about 75 music therapists practicing in the state of Oregon. We service preschool children, early intervention programs, children with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, children in hospitals, children in hospice care, palliative care, children in bereavement programs, adults with mental health issues, adults with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, with brain injuries, elders that are well, and assisted living, memory care, rehabilitation. Some of the local hospitals that music therapists are currently working in. Oregon State Hospital has 13 music therapists. Six of them are doing the direct service, and several of them are administrative positions. We have music therapists working at Portland Adventist Medical Center and in the mental health unit there, in their hospice and palliative care units that has just recently increased over this last year. We have music therapists that are working at Good Samaritan Hospital and Dwayne Becker, working with children with cancer through the Children's Cancer Association. Music therapists working at Providence Hospital. We have a music therapy intern working at the Providence Child Center, working with medically fragile children. Music therapists working with Elder Place, which is residential and daycare services for elders. Music therapists providing services at Southwest Washington Medical Center, and also music therapy practicum at Kaiser Hospital. We're providing mental health services through Cascadia Mental Health. We provide music therapy groups at Premier Living. We work with developmental disabilities in foster care homes, private homes, one-on-one, and small groups. We work with Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Washington County developmental disability programs, Inclusion Incorporated, Mentor Incorporated, Good Shepherd, Portland Parks and Recreation, Tualatin in Parks and Recreation, Elders through Volunteers of America at Lambert House East and also at Marie Smith Center, private individuals through guardianships, and a lot of foster care homes. So music therapists are out there practicing.
Can we get eventually a list of all that at some point?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I think that's very valuable.
Absolutely. We'll definitely email that to you this afternoon. There's multiple stories of positive outcomes. I'd be happy to send you testimonials from clients, from their parents, from other music therapists that are providing practice in the area.
So you're saying that this bill would prevent music therapists from calling themselves music therapists?
That's correct.
And so you basically you'd be fine with this bill if that Section 5 was changed to include those of you who are gainfully employed using music therapists, art therapists, and that's the issue. Not the reimbursement issue.
That's correct.
I think that's what the public has to realize, that this is just focusing on being able to still use this word in your profession.
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay. Do we have time for me to read a letter to you that was drafted by our national association?
I would love to have a copy of that, and if we have time, if at the end, I think would be.
You do have
get
a copy
it.
In your packet.
We do.
Yes.
Okay.
Can I make
yes.
just
yes.
The one other piece that is very important is the protection of the title of art therapist or music therapist, because there are people who have been practicing calling themselves that but do not have any type of training within one of the expressive art therapies. And so that is another part of the amendment that we would be requesting.
Okay, and my staff, do we have a copy of that amendment yet? No, we don't have. So as soon as I have your email and Short's email. Yeah, okay. So you will be able, if there's someone else who would like to get copies of the wording of the amendments that are coming through, and also it has to pass muster with the proponents of the bill, too, so that, you know, it isn't just getting your input, it's getting input of the proponents of the bill, too. So once we have that, then we'll be sending it out. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you
coming.
Very much.
I really appreciate you being here. Beth Ann Short, Mary Lowe's, and Jessica Schaller. Schaller?
Are you ready?
Schaller?
Yeah.
Grandma's ready.
Good day. Thank you again for having us speak on this, Madam Chair, and the committee that's here. So I'm sure you have copies of the email that I had sent, but I would like to just today testify as an art therapist.
Introduce yourself first.
Oh, I'm Beth Ann Short. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
I am an art therapist, and today I want to talk as an art therapist in the community of how, if this wasn't amended, would affect myself, my clients, and those I serve. So to do this, I need to give you a little bit of background of who I am. I won't take up a ton of time because I know it's sensitive, but I did go to Melhurst, graduated in 99. I worked for companies including Morrison Center for a number of years as an outpatient therapist. I worked for Providence as a on-ward, on-call therapist on 6E and 6L, which is an inpatient unit for children and adolescents. And I've also worked for the Boys and Girls AIDS Society as a mental health art therapist. And in all of these places, I advocated to have the term art therapist in my title, although I did work alongside with LCSWs, LMFTs, who, and in all these places, I was billed as a licensed, you know, qualified mental health professional as they were. So to rule out my title would take that away from me on one level. I have my ATR credentials from the American Art Therapy Association, and I got them as soon as I could out of school. I worked and got my supervision hours with licensed professionals and ATRs that were already registered and working in the field. And in the past 9 years, when I worked in community mental health, I worked with youth, their families, lots, again, of the same clients that Sherry talked about, the foster kids. With Morrison Center, I was an outpatient therapist for those kids, so that was rich being here for that part. In my 9 years, I worked with a variety of diagnoses, all I was trained for in my clinical training. It was rigorous. I felt like I was supervised in an appropriate manner in my training. And I have fulfilled the national requirements to maintain my registration with American Art Therapy Association. In the last year, I started my own private practice. And in this setting, I work with families. I not only am an art therapist, but I'm also an artist and do some other things like teach art. But I am still an art therapist. And I'm working now primarily with children who have type 1 diabetes and their families. I'm also working, I was contacted and contracted with by Kaiser to come and work at Kaiser with kids who are type 1 diabetics and their families. We also have Cascadia doing a regular group at our studio every week. So that would take that away from those folks. And I'm sorry, I'm kind of emotional.
Doing fine.
I have also been, I'm a scheduled speaker to speak at the Oregon Association for Play Therapy to help those folks use art therapy ethically in their 2009 symposium here in the state. And we are also trying to, in my studio, educate the community on art therapy. We're having our own trainings throughout March and, you know, trying to encourage the knowledge of the benefits of art therapy in the community. But all of this would be prohibited if we couldn't use that title. So that's kind of, I definitely understand the licensure and the need for protecting people from unethical providers, but I feel like this is written in a way that it would affect so many people.
Okay.
In that way. So,
thank
yeah.
you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and Committee, thank you for having us. My name is Mary Lowes, and although I am a new music therapist, I practiced as a registered nurse for 30 years, and I just, in terms of the training for music therapy and the clinical work, it was quite rigorous, very well supervised, and when I graduated as a nurse, we did not have any internship. When I graduated from music therapy, I had 1,000-hour supervision. Also, the BC is our board credential, which is a national exam, and then they also maintain all our records, continue education, and follow up if there's any issues. And the websites have all our code of ethics, the standards of practice, what we're allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do. So I feel very strongly about this as well, because I'd like to get going in my new career. So.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, welcome. Hi, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Jessica Schaller. I'm a board-certified music therapist, and I actually currently work in the Salem area. I am been starting the first full-time hospice music therapy program in the state of Oregon, so we've been really excited about that. And Willamette Valley Hospice chose to hire a board-certified music therapist to develop that program because of the training, the requirements, the code of ethics, and the standards of practice. And Willamette Valley Hospice really explored its variety of options in the profession that it was going to hire to take on that new position in that program. I'm here in support to have there be amendment, because it really does impact the services and who would be able to receive music therapy services. My training is to have my bachelor's and my master's degree in music therapy. The 1,400 required supervision hours was what it was at the time that I was doing my internship, which was a 6-month fully supervised internship in a hospital setting. Since I have been professionally working, which is about almost 10 years now, I have also been in the role as a supervisor myself through graduate programs at Colorado State, which is where I did my master's. And I also supervise some of the students from Merrill Hirsch University here when they come and do a project placement in hospice, and also in our bereavement support that we do to children and families that we work with. I am not here to speak about the reimbursement issue, but more around who's allowed to use the term of therapist and music therapist. I really agree with the need to have that be individuals who are trained and doing what they say they do within the boundaries and the limitations that are set by their profession, by their code of ethics, by their standards of practice. And music therapy does have that. Because of our standards and because of our code of ethics and because of the board certification, we are required to go and sit for either an exam every 5 years again to keep us certified, or we go for the 100 continuing education hours every 5 years to ensure that we're still maintaining that highest level of education, of training. In addition, I speak nationally as well as statewide to the National Hospice Organization as well as the Music Therapy Organization. And one of the things that I advocate for is the definition of who is a music therapist. And I advocate for people who are not trained and board certified as music therapists to be using that term music therapy outside of that context. So I agree with what you're doing and ask that you do it with consideration of those of us who are practicing professionally, ethically within our profession that is true to ourselves. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions? Any other comments?
I have one last thing. You know, there are so many art therapists. Merrill Hirsch has been, this program's been around since 86. So there, you know, we're just speaking, this few of us, for so many folks. And maybe you got a big response. I hope you
yes,
did.
Yes, I did. That's why you're here.
Yeah. So, yeah, we just really hope that you'll hear us and can
thank you.
And I would like to just say, I think in Salem in particular, there have been some recent PR about music therapy. Last spring, I believe in April, there was a feature article in the Statesman Journal, as well as then the article that came out in the Polk County paper around music therapy, in particular a pediatric case that was cited around the hospice that we were using here. And so if you're looking to gain more information in particular as to how music therapy functions or has benefited the children and the adults in the Salem community, I think that could be something that you could have access to easily here.
Okay, that's good to know. We'll mark
let
that.
Let us know if you have any other questions. Or
you bet.
Yeah.
We know how to contact
thank you.
You.
Very much.
All right. Thank you very much. Elizabeth, are there any other? That's it.
Yeah,
now we finally get to the proponents of the bill. All right. Elizabeth Akushwa, Marcus Berglund, Mary Lou Brophy. And it would be nice, since we really know your issue pretty well, if you could maybe address some of the issues that the people before you have addressed. Because you'll be this bill will be evidently putting a lot of people out of business. And that's not what we're all about.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Mary Lou Brophy from Jacksonville, Oregon, and I coordinate the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice. And, Madam Chair, if you would indulge me a personal moment to say happy birthday to Senator Gordley.
Thank you.
should we sing? No. I've done that already.
This coalition includes, to answer a question once asked by Senator Gordley, licensed marriage family therapist, licensed professional counselors, licensed clinical social workers, licensed school counselors, educators at various colleges and universities, and particularly, Chair Mona Sanderson, the other day a school nurse phoned me to say that in any given day, over 85% of her high school students who come in to see the school nurse are coming in for mental health issues. And so she's tremendously supportive of our bill because she's feeling the burden on school nurses and school counselors because, particularly in rural areas, there are just not enough of us out there to support her work and to help out. And, of course, with family insurance, there are so many, without that, there are so many who cannot be seen. But I want to do what you said and address some of the issues made here today. I, as a licensed professional for 26 years now, I mean, I have tremendous regard and respect for art therapy, music therapy, play therapy, to access some of those areas of the unconscious that just verbal therapy cannot address. And so, you know, this bill is never meant to hurt anybody. It's only meant to get us really out there to really treat so many of the issues. The people on Children's Services were here, the Vietnam veterans. Those are painful, painful things, and I really want us to be part of the solution on all of those things. Now, you may recall from prior testimony that LPCs and LMFTs are required by our laws to give each new client a public disclosure statement. And in that public disclosure statement, which is one sheet long, at the bottom of it is our code of ethics. And beneath that is the name of our board, the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. There's the address. There is the phone number. So they not only have the code of ethics, but they have accessibility for each client. In case there is a need to report, a redress of grievances can occur. So our regulatory board provides consumers access to protection. And it's a mechanism for accountability. That is the big thing. And thereby, those of us mental health professionals who choose to be licensed. Now, the state of Oregon doesn't require us to be licensed, but who choose to be licensed do so because we consider submitting ourselves to our regulatory board. It is not a bureaucratic hoop for us. It is submitting ourselves to a regulatory board so that, in fact, our profession is upgraded. We are encouraged to work together to operate at a high frequency of professionalism. We are protecting our own professional selves as well as consumers. So licensing is to us a very important thing. And I am encouraging people to rethink the importance of having a regulatory board. So many people I talk to are kind of amazed that while real estate brokers and mechanics and so on, doctors and nurses have a regulatory board when we work in the area of mental health, that we could be allowed to practice without having that. So our House Bill 3616 does not mean to imply that there are not some wonderful professionals out there who are unlicensed, but it's not their fault that the state of Oregon has not required licensing. And many of the people from whom you've heard in terms of the art and music therapy, play therapy, and so on, they certainly, many of them have the qualifications to be licensed. And it is really your call to decide how important it is for mental health professionals of whatever variety to be operating under a regulatory board. So we have a panel here today to answer any questions you might have further. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. Thank you, committee.
I was going to say good morning, but now I'll say good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa.
But we don't say good evening.
As long as you don't say good night. My name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice.
You are familiar with the bill. It consists basically of two parts. This is a similar, although not identical, bill to a bill that you considered last session. Unfortunately, as the October Oregonian mentioned, this is a problem that is facing mental health consumers throughout Oregon, and it's one that we really feel needs to be addressed for the protection of vulnerable people. The bill really has two basic parts to it. The first, we believe, is the strong consumer protection part. It is the title portion of the bill. It says that you can't call yourself a therapist or a counselor unless you are licensed by a regulated board. There are exceptions in Section 5, as we've noted. We have not seen the amendments for the art therapists yet. We are understanding of their position, and we believe that the language that is being crafted will address their issues, and we would be fine with that. Our most important parts that we're here about are the consumer protection argument, where we really need to pay attention to the amount of education, the amount of training, the amount of clinically supervised hours that are out there, and we don't want people who are fraudulently representing themselves to be taking advantage of people who are in crisis. Individuals and families in crisis make a giant leap of faith when they choose to seek help, and they need to know that they can trust the people who are hanging out a shingle. And this bill is about protecting these most vulnerable people. Because whether we want to admit it or not, people seeking mental health care still have a stigma attached to them, and they don't want to be taken advantage of twice. To that end, the other adjustment we've made here is to increase the licensing board's ability to fine people egregious behavior from up to $1,000 to up to $2,500. We feel that this is really putting the additional teeth in the bill that allows the state-regulated licensing board to really enforce this law. That's the first part of the bill, consumer protection. The second part of the bill is really does speak to access, and it speaks to access by having licensed medical or licensed marriage and family therapists and licensed professional counselors be covered only if current health benefit plans cover similar services. If you will refer quickly to your blue sheet, I'll bust through this quickly. I know everybody's starving. The first two columns are people who are already required by Oregon State to be covered.
And just I hate to interrupt, but it'd be nice if you could get a copy of this and then let us know how your training corresponds here for future reference. Yeah.
The other two columns, the LMFTs and the LPCs, are not required. You'll move down all four.
And they are located in there's some in the back. Be sure to pick it up. Okay, sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, there are new people here that aren't used to how we do this, and everyone's testimony we put in the back, mm-hmm. those who give it to us. All right. Now you can.
Okay. Quickly going down across the board.
Start over again. The first two are covered.
The first two, the state required, the health benefit plans covered. That's the yeses. In the first column. The two no's are the no, not yet required. Okay. So what we're trying to do here is actually conform these two professions to the other two. The second line, licensure board, licensure Oregon State licensure boards are the same, equivalent educational degrees, equivalent licensing boards, equivalent program length and service hours. In some cases, more service client service supervised hours than the ones who are currently covered. So what we're trying to do here is essentially add these two professions, and this will speak especially to rural access because we all know that in rural areas they do not have the number of professionals in any profession, quite frankly, that metropolitan areas have, and to allow people to have the additional coverage will allow them to increase their options for mental health care and the access as well. So, again, in terms of anything else, we were a little surprised. We hadn't heard from the art therapist before, but we are not in any way here to tell anyone that they impinge upon their rights to practice. And if the amendments speak to what we think they're going to speak to, I think that we can be comfortable as long as we are looking at these two halves of the bill
separately
for our clients and separately.
Yeah.
I've gotten a couple of other emails. One, considering the name gambling therapist, as well as pastoral. There's a lot of pastoral counseling done, and some are using therapists with pastoral, and I know they get counseling in their divinity school. So I'm not sure where that falls in. There's no one here to testify on that issue. DHS will be testifying on Friday. So,
actually, Chair Mona Sanderson, the bill does speak pretty clearly to a couple of those things. Some concerns earlier under Section 5, to people who are in training, students who are in training are exempted from this bill. The change that we understand that has been made from DHS, which we fully support, is the change from certified drug and alcohol counselor to certified addictions counselors, which would cover that. We are fully supportive of that amendment. We're entirely supportive of the DHS amendments. And also, speaking to some of the other things that people had said, Section 5 sub D says, terms counselor or therapist as used by qualified mental health professionals employed in community health programs, you heard that before, approved by DHS. And so those are also exempted. So I feel that those things are covered. The bill speaks to people practicing in their scopes of practice, and pastoral care is clearly just that, pastoral care. We're not trying to stop people from doing it. Sorry. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Question?
Yes, Senator Morissette. Does this bill have a fiscal?
No. Chairman Sanderson, no. Senator Morissette, no, the bill does not have a fiscal.
PEB just informed me, yeah, that they already cover family therapists, I believe. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senators Gordley and Morissette, good to see you again after many conversations. I so appreciate your patience.
Old home week.
That's right. Homecoming as well as birthday and Valentine's Day. I'm Marcus Berglund, the president of the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, volunteer position, and for employment of family therapists and clinical supervisor for Catholic Community Services. I know you've heard the run-through, so I don't want to take up your precious time, although just to mention some contextual pieces. And aside, since you were, Madam Chair, curious about reactions to the prior testimony, especially of the art and music therapists, to reiterate what Mary Lou and Elizabeth have said, no intention whatsoever of trying to usurp the abilities of trained professionals in the mental health field. What, as a side thought, and I think you were alluding to, Senator Mona Sanderson, Madam Chair, to having a more local process for grievances for the art therapists. It seems to be an evolutionary kind of deal where each mental health discipline at one time, before the state has license, you became a member of a national organization. That used to be the case for MFTs, marriage and family therapists. Because there was no state licensure before 1990, you had to become, if you wanted the gold standard of credential, become a clinical member and ultimately an approved supervisor with the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Obviously, then the next step for the most clear regulatory and licensing criteria, you would need to go through and then have a state license board be created. It's kind of, as I see, kind of an evolutionary kind of step. So I don't doubt the qualifications whatsoever of art and music therapists. However, I would suggest, as an aside, as we look at these issues for the future, that the next step would certainly have a more localized regulatory board than a national North Carolina-based grievance set. The other aside with Mel,
and I hate to say this because we are also territorial for you art therapists and music therapists. I'm a nurse by trade, and so we are very territorial. But I don't know
if there are subsets to the various boards that are already in existence.
Well, that's what I was going to say about the Merrill Hirsch training, which I have worked with many art therapists and don't doubt for a moment their credentials, that their curriculum, at least currently, is prepares them to take their LPC credential. I think that's a key contextual fact here, mm-hmm. that they already have the wherewithal and the training to pursue that licensure and therefore have all the oversight that you would want. Again, that's an aside. I'm not making any recommendation, just more information out there.
That's a different issue.
Yeah.
Different time.
Yeah, absolutely. But just to know that. Contextually for our bill, it becomes all the more acute, I so appreciate the order of which the testimony came, especially with the foster care family and domestic violence issues, that's what we as LPCs and LMFTs deal with on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And I don't think our credibility is in question. We've not had that seriously done other than certain testimonials. In regard to that, again, honoring your request for rebuttal, nobody who is an LPC or LMFT has not taken national boards that would show that you've had appropriate training on assessment, diagnosis, and treatment. And so the charge that you are, some are qualified, some are not, is specious if, in fact, you have the LPC or LMFT designation, because by definition, your education and then the board that you must take, the national board that you must take for that designation, would encompass those three aspects especially. Other contextual pieces with the regard to shortage of mental health professionals, especially in rural districts, that continues to be so acute. I'm not sure if people are familiar with the Human Services and Resources Administration Board, but they look on a federal level at the shortage areas of mental health issues especially, and 85% of the designated mental health professional shortage areas in the United States are in rural areas. Oregon has 26 rural counties. Representative Maurer and others have testified mm-hmm. eloquently about this issue, but I think it bears repeating that we have a fully staffed and trained cadre of mental health professionals and LPCs and LMFTs, and by giving them the green light to practice their trade and to provide the services that are so needed, that is an easy fix, so to speak, and those are rare indeed to have easy fixes. The other piece that I think bears repetition is the fact that returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, conservative estimates are 20% of that population has some form of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I say that is highly, highly conservative. In fact, one legislator said probably more like 99 to 100% of them have, just being in that context. The ramifications of that are huge when, in terms, you look at their partners, their kids, their co-workers, their community members are going to be affected by their maladjustment. And in turn, their kids especially and family members can develop emotional problems and maladjustments, and I've been privy to many of those cases. In fact, I have a colleague in Grants Pass who is treating a number of military families who've been returned home, and they're having to pay out of pocket because their insurance companies don't cover their services, and the Veterans Administration is so overwhelmed that even though MFT and LPC services are covered by the Veterans Administration, that's only in paper only, but not in reality. So those are some of the anecdotal pieces that are happening within that shortage area in rural areas. Another piece, medical cost offset. I think it's really important to realize that the cost of this, some folks have been concerned about, well, adding providers is going to actually increase the costs to insurance companies and therefore passed on to the premium increases of subscribers in general. Research has not shown that to be true at all. In fact, when greater mental health services are offered, medical utilization rates go down. Numerous consistent studies show that medical cost offset is the term, plummet when mental health services are appropriately made available. And that those...
Question.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Does a psychologist charge more than a family therapist?
Absolutely.
Okay. So
the reason for that, excuse me, because doctoral level versus master's level training, although about a third of MFTs in the nation are doctoral level, but typically the answer would be psychologists would definitely charge more.
And it'll be interesting to know, because I know that psychologists and psychiatrists, there was a difference for reimbursement rates, but now the gap is closing, I think, from the insurer's point of view. Anyway, it'll be interesting because we're always looking at cost containment,
yes.
But usually those that start low end up being saying, well, I'm doing the same thing that he is. I need to be reimbursed at a higher rate. But that's, again, another conversation.
True enough, but I think your point's well taken. That will never be the same totally because of the difference in training. If a psychologist PhD level mental health provider is charging a certain rate, a master's level clinician will not ever be charging that same rate or be reimbursed for that same rate. So that's the difference. And Representative Maher also made the point kind of along that line is that on his floor speech that the greater the supply, the increase in provider pool, the greater supply is going to have a tendency to drive down costs, not increase costs. And there are studies to bear him out. The other piece, there is a specific study that was done in 1985 in the state of Oregon when licensed social workers began to be covered on a statewide basis. And they found that the actual cost of services decreased overall because they were lower cost providers than the psychiatrists or psychologists providing mental health services.
Good. All right. Thanks. We might as well call DHS up too. But Jeff Tobano?
Todal.
Sorry. We brutalized that one. And Laura Barnes.
Thank you.
And DHS. And because then on Friday, we'll have what we'll be doing on Friday is just looking at the amendments and then seeing what the committee wants to do.
The reality of the situation is that when we do an amendment, we're going to have to send it back to a conference committee, and it's going to have to come back to both bodies, and we are going to run out of time if we do not act expeditiously. We have to do that.
So hopefully there'll be pretty much agreement, because I would love to move it Friday. That just gives us that extra window of time if we're going to move it. And so hopefully we'll be able to
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to hear you say that, because I too would like to see this move on Friday, and I believe that we can do that. I do want to say, and this is anticipating that some of those who came to testify might leave before we actually complete our hearing, I just want to say thank you again to the art therapy and music the therapy folks who came. I think what you have succeeded in doing today is elevating the conversation, and you've made a good point of or you've helped us better understand the importance of an array of services that needs to be available and deliverable to those needing mental health services in our state. So I want to thank you on the record for making that happen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Which one? We'll let DHS end up.
Okay.
No disrespect.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Laura Barnes. I am an MFT student at the University of Oregon, my second year, so my final year. I'm also the student liaison to the OAMFT, the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapists, as well. So I coordinate between the four main schools of MFT, so I can really only speak to that and not the LPC side. But just in talking with my colleagues, just things that they wanted me to present here and talk to you about, and really just briefly, we wanted to speak generally about the rigor of the education that we receive, of the supervision of our class load in terms of diagnostics, providing treatment-based, treatment plan-based services. We have a 12-month internship in which we're supervised weekly, both on-site and off-site with our faculty members before we take our final sort of master's thesis step, do that, and register as registered interns. And so that process is a 3-year-long process where we're continuing to get quite a lot of supervision weekly to make sure that we're meeting the level of care, the standard of care for our clients and for the profession. So it's something that we take extremely seriously. Most of my colleagues and I have sort of come to an agreement. The reason why we chose marriage and family therapy was because it offered a rigor in training for both couples, families, and children like no other profession provides. And so really addressing those key core components with evidence-based practices and, you know, treatment goals-based therapy is really pivotal to the services that we're offering.
Thank you. Questions? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jeff Todahl, and I'm the director of the Couples and Family Therapy Program at the University of Oregon, where Laura is a student. And I want to speak briefly to the training that our students receive, and I'm speaking to some extent on behalf of the 10 programs in the state that prepare licensed professional counselors in LNFTs. For family therapists, they are required by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy to acquire 128 core competencies. And so as a trainer and a director of a training program, it's my responsibility to evaluate the extent to which they meet those competencies by the time they graduate. And a bit about the categories of those competencies, they include the admissions to treatment, clinical assessment and diagnosis, treatment planning and case management, ethics, standards, research, and we emphasize also best practices and empirically validated therapies to ensure that our students are grounding their work in the latest research evidence that supports the work that they're doing.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question here regarding your list? Where does cultural competency fit within that list and within what you are, how you're training students for the 21st century?
Yes, thank you. That's an excellent question. We have gone to a place where we believe it's important to embed cultural competency. And we think about diversity broadly, from cultural competency to disabilities to working with a variety of populations. So we embed that. We have a course specific
excellent.
To diversity, but it's embedded across our curriculum.
I'm so pleased to hear the word embed. Perfect. Thank you.
I'm happy to hear that. a bit more about the rigor. It includes 73 graduate credits, 22 advanced classes spanning at least 200 years, 500 client contacts across the 12-month internship, and the client contact includes live and videotape supervision. So I see Laura's work. It's not virtual sort of imagination about what she's doing. I see her work on a weekly basis. A 12-month internship at the Center for Family Therapy, which is our training clinic, and then a concurrent 12-month internship at a community-based organization. They take a comprehensive exam prior to being allowed to see clients in their first year. We cover diagnosis and treatment in a specific course, and then it is also embedded across our curriculum. A comprehensive written and oral defense at the end of their program of studies. And then at the point of graduation, they still are not eligible to be licensed in the state of Oregon. They need to go beyond that, which includes completion of 2,000 post-degree direct client contact hours under the supervision of someone who's been approved by the Oregon Board to provide supervision at a ratio of 20 to 1. So for 20 client contact hours, 1 hour of direct supervision. And then they also have to pass a National Marital and Family Therapy Exam or the National Counselor's Exam. Yes, and I've been doing this work for 10 years, and I feel good about the training that our students are receiving. And I think it's very rigorous and that they are competent and qualified. And also our program is only admitting about 30% of the students, the people that apply to the program. So we already make a decision about the quality of the people that come into our program even from the beginning. So.
Madam
Chair. Yes, Senator Gorley.
Where does your program rank within the state, looking at other state institutions and nationally?
I'm not aware of any official rankings that happen with family therapy. We're the only program that is nationally accredited by AMFT, our particular program. The other programs are accredited by a couple of other national bodies. The College of Education calls itself at the U of O the number one ranked college in terms of its external grant funding, but that's all secondary to the work we're doing. So.
Thank you.
Certainly last, but not least.
Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Andy Smith. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of DHS. And the amendment that we, it is, I believe, part of the amendment that also deals with music and art therapists. But what it would do is essentially correct an omission that we've identified in the bill, and that is people that can use the terms counselor or counseling. Right now, as written, this is on page 3 of the bill, line 34, if you happen to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it just suggests that, or states that a certified alcohol and drug counselor can use those terms. And what we failed to identify would be we also have gambling addictions counselors that are very much very similarly important to the work that we do. So we feel that there should be, the language should be adjusted, so that would include not only A and D counselors, but also gambling addiction counselors.
Great. Appreciate that, and those I know those amendments, all of the amendments have been submitted, and then we will be getting them to DHS. I'm having my staff in the back remember this, or Sandy. We need to get them to DHS. We need to get them to Kristen, and then our art therapists and our music therapists, and we have their emails, and I think we send in. I think I sent them on to you, too. Is there anyone else who needs copies of the... Okay. All right. This has been very... I'm sorry it's so late, but I think it was extremely... We have to be extremely efficient, and if we have to go through noon hour, because we only have two more weeks left, and we're going to be out of here. So, yes.
Madam Chair, before you gavel out, which I believe is what you're about to do, may I put some comments on record from our student who visited with us earlier? Again, on behalf of Jayla Harper, she's 12 years old, she listened intently to our discussion around foster care and medication. And she wants us to know that children like to stay in one home and not move so much. Just because the doctor says so doesn't mean what the doctor says is right. Foster parents, I think, should know what they are giving in terms of medication to a child, is what she's saying. If you wouldn't want that medication given to your own child, then we shouldn't be giving it to our foster children. Not all children need medication. Some just need discipline. I suggest that we don't use it or any kind of medication because the medication only makes the problem invisible to the child and other people, but the problem is still there. I would say, being a child myself, that the child only needs love, discipline, and a caring family, or at least caring friends.
Wow.
Jayla Harper.
Whoa, for a 12-year-old, Jayla. Will you please send my extreme thanks for the words and tenor she and hopefully she will. She's obviously going to be an extremely important part of our society.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Tell her to look about running for office. We need some talented people here. All right. With that, we're adjourned.